you. Welcome back to another episode of Conversations with Nova Reed. And it is with slight heavy heart today. It is our final episode of season one. Heavy heart because endings always make me feel sad. They also make me feel excited for what's to come. But can you believe we've been going since the 6th of April. And when I first started this podcast series, I had no idea what direction it would go in, or that there would be 19 episodes and we'd be running for so many weeks and witnessing and moving through so much societal unrest, shift, awakening. And I couldn't be more proud to have been able to support you through this. And if you're discovering this outside of these turbulent times, then I wonder what it would be like listening and reflecting back. And I need to let you know before I get carried away, I am using racist language in this episode to depict some factual moments, and I am also describing some quite extreme examples of racism. So if you are black or brown or a person of colour, then my recommendation is you exercise self-care and proceed with caution. But yeah, it's with heavy heart. It's the final episode this week, and also it's been a tough week for me on a personal level, and I'm going to talk about that a little bit. I'm also going to talk about just witnessing a speech by Barack Obama at civil rights activists John Lewis funeral, and that was enough to motivate me into recording the episode today, because we know this should have gone out earlier, and I was not feeling like giving you a podcast episode. And I think what I am discovering as I'm writing this new book, The Good Ally, for all the world and all the eyes to see, is not only the extraordinary amount of pressure I am placing on myself, and that's not new behaviour, working through it, but writing a book about racism in the middle of the biggest times of global racial injustice movement. And that was backed up by civil rights activist Angela Davis, who said in June, I believe, June or July, I can't remember now, everything floods in June or July, that she has never seen such a global movement towards race injustice in her lifetime. And I'm just saying that again. I've said it before on this podcast because I want you to absorb and process the magnitude of a historical landscape that we are living and breathing and moving through right now. I just want to let that land. There has never been such a global movement for racial justice. Never in our lifetime. In lifetime of civil rights activists like the late John Lewis and Angela Davis and others. So, you know, this is big. This is huge. So writing a book about racism in the middle of some very challenging times and being a black woman was very difficult for me this week. And I read a comment from, I think it was Natalie, who if you haven't heard the previous episode, please do listen. We're talking about how racism shows up in relationships and in education and all of the stuff. And I think she said something like, it's like you're in the middle of the eye of the storm. And that couldn't be a more poignant metaphor right now. Because not only am I specifically writing in the middle of these difficult socio-political times and this civil unrest, writing a book about racism as a black woman means that I am remembering some moments, experiences of racism that I have forgotten and suppressed. it means that I'm bringing to surface those that are some of the biggest memories. And it means I'm also experiencing new versions or new moments of racism all at once. And writing them down, seeing them on the page, seeing how many examples, experiences, moments of racial abuse I receive from the everyday stuff, from well-meaning friends, going into shops, walking down the road, to the more overt, direct abuse. And seeing them in black and white on a page and literally having to decide which one to pick. There are so many. There are so many. They can't all go in the book. That in itself is really, really painful and sobering. Because what happens when you experience racism, there is an element of you that you end up almost normalizing it. You don't want to shine a spotlight on it because it might be too overwhelming, or you receive further abuse when you speak up about it, or you just want to get on and live your damn life without having to deal with isms, racism all of the time. And you end up just suppressing, swallowing, by letting things go so much at the expense often of our own well-being. And just seeing it on the page, so many incidents, past and present, was really, really painful. And it's the part of, like, writing a book is intense anyway, and I would love to hear from people who have already written a book about a romance novel to hear if that intensity is any different, just in terms of the process. But writing a book about racism, or any kind of abuse when you are also still living and breathing and experiencing that is, it's all of the stuff. It's painful. It's very painful. And I imagine once I'm out of the eye of the storm and I'm further towards the end of writing it, it will probably be quite a cathartic experience. But as I talk about with healing, especially in the episode with Ade Adeniji, when we talk about healing, it's like we have to look at the wound, man. It's not going to be pleasant and pretty all of the time. So I recognize that, but I'm just giving you a snippet of, you know, you see a polished version, you see the joyful version of Nova, you see the upbeat version of me, and I'm just giving you a snippet of what goes on underneath in order to hold space for the magnitude of this work, and to provide a vehicle for all of us to do better. And I have found, and it, I think it's demonstrated in, like, if you watch a TED talk, I imagine the TED talks that move you the most are the ones where people are sharing about their own experiences of overcoming something, their own experiences of adversity. Our stories, the things that make us who we are the things that hook us in. So I recognize that in order to help people understand the work, the most powerful thing I can do is give examples of my own experience of systemic racism and abuse. So it's the swings, it's all of the stuff. What equally made this week tough, it's the anniversary of 2 deaths in the Black community. Violent deaths. We often hear, you know, when I started this podcast, it was in the middle of a global, you know, the beginnings of a global pandemic, a CV19. And then halfway through that, we were seeing such violent atrocities on Black bodies in the US, violent murders by law enforcement, and that uprising that came from it. So we've definitely leaned in far deeper in this first series of the podcast than I ever would have imagined, just because I can't create. It is impossible for me to create and not be influenced and impacted by what is going on in the world around me. As a creative, I find it impossible unless you are actively doing something to avoid. I find that impossible not to be impacted by what's going on around you. So, you know, the sort of retorts that I've been hearing as the momentum for Black Lives Movements is starting to slow down and start to be challenged and start to be critiqued and start to be pulled apart. I heard from one colleague recently who works in education talking about what they can be doing to bring more of the full extent of British history into school curriculums. That includes more about hearing about civil unrest, hearing about the injustices that happen in the UK to the Black community, hearing more about the, you know, I say this with a caveat, Black history, so you know what I mean, but it's all of our history. It's part of British history. So they're wanting to, you know, encourage discussions about what can we do to make our curriculum more representative and more whole as a result of what's been going on and triggered by the murder of primarily, not exclusively, but primarily George Floyd. And the response they got from a senior manager was, why are you wasting my time? This happened in America. And I think that's the key thing. We can be so ignorant about what is going on under our noses because we choose not to look, because it's not our experience. So this week, some of the heaviness for me came, it's the anniversary of Joy Gardner and Anthony Walker's death. And these happened right here in the UK. I'm going to be talking about some violent murders. So if you do not want to hear what happens next, feel free to skip. Joy Gardner was living in North London and she was of Jamaican heritage. And the British government and police had deemed that she was illegal and shouldn't be here. They broke into her home in the early hours of the morning when she was asleep. And tied 13 feet of tape around her mouth and her body so that she couldn't scream for help. This was all in front of her five-year-old son. She suffocated to death before she even got to hospital. 27 years later, still no justice. This is a huge case in the UK. Barely anybody has heard about it. And that, you know, there's another piece to this here. We often historically will cling more to the cases of men who have died at the hands of brutal murder, and we forget about Black women. That's a, you know, I'm going to go into that in season two. Anthony Walker, probably more known because I believe there was a documentary, I haven't seen it yet, that went out very recently that talks about the life he could have lived had he not died. He was 18 at the time and, you know, living his life, waiting for a bus at the bus stop, as many of us do. Waiting at a bus stop in Merseyside, Liverpool, and a group of young white lads came and put an ice axe into his skull. These are things that happen in the UK. That was in 2005. Most of us will know about the Stephen Lawrence case. And if you don't, again, the question is why not? On Friday last week, there was an attack in Bristol. And the identity of the person, the victim who received the attack, has not yet been revealed. So I don't know his name. But he was a young Black guy working in hospital. So he's a hospital worker. Remember the people we were clapping for and painting rainbows for a few months ago? He'd finished a shift, left hospital, and was deliberately and intentionally mowed down by a car by, I will name them, some white supremacists, and who yelled, fucking nigger. He sustained such horrific lacerations to his face. He's going to need reconstructive plastic surgery to fix it. He also has a number of broken bones. Just finished a shift in hospital. This happened on Friday, which I think was the 24th of July. And perhaps what made this incident even more, I mean, it's upsetting in isolation, but what made it even more sobering was for the first time, like this moment, this movement is bringing up trauma. It's bringing up things that we have suppressed in order to just live and try and thrive and just crack on without having to deal with the reality of racial abuse. But it triggers trauma. So stuff that you've repressed can start coming out that you may have even forgotten about. And for the first time, I was chatting with my older brother a few weeks ago, and he shared for the first time one of the most overt forms of racism he's ever experienced. And what made that incident in Bristol so sobering is because how close it was to what happened to my brother, who was out on a Friday night getting fish and chips, as most Brits do. And he encountered somebody who was extremely racist, who attempted to mow my brother down with his van, whilst shouting, "Fuck off back to your own country." Like, that's why this stuff is so painful, because each of us can think about someone in our lives who has experienced something like that and had a near getaway, or has had and received extreme abuse that may have ended in, if not serious injury, than death. It's close. It's so close to us. So the heaviness of just seeing my own experience of past and present racism on a page and having to pick like a bloody sweet pick and mix for a book, remembering the anniversary of human beings like Joy Gardner, Anthony Walker, and so many more, hearing about this new attack and seeing the tirade, Wiley's anti-Semitic tirade, and just being so deeply saddened by what he did, and seeing the pain that caused, and then equally seeing the divide that it also called, the further divide, the excuse for anti-blackness to come out, the excuse for I'm sick and tired of Black Lives Matter. And so just feeling the heaviness and the weight of that and the sadness that surrounds that, because it just takes you back. It's like you come further forward and then you go, it feels like you go right back again. But then I was listening to Barack Obama today, giving a 40-minute eulogy at the late John Lewis's funeral. Barack was back on his stage, and it reminded me of how important it is to see these types of people in your life on a regular basis, inspiring change and inspiring you with their words and role modeling what change and perseverance can look like. And so he was talking a lot about John's life, and he said something that I just want to share with you today. And it couldn't be more true. Like, the work we're doing now, I often say to my students on my anti-racism course, like, we need to be motivated to do this work, to serve a cause that's beyond ourselves, because we won't see the seismic change that we are longing for, hoping for, doing this work for in our generation. We just won't see it. Doesn't mean we're not going to see shifts, for sure. We're already experiencing that. We're not going to see the monumental change that leads to better race equity first and then better equality second in our lifetime. So you've got to be motivated to serve something that doesn't directly, immediately benefit you. Like, this is something that's greater than all of us. And he said, Barack said this, and it just really resonated with me. What gives each generation purpose is doing the unfinished work of the last generation and to carry it further than any one of us thought would be possible. Like, that's the reason I do this work. I say to you always, like, I, you know, when I was a little girl, I wanted to be a hairdresser and then, you know, dance on musical theatre stages. That was it, you know. I'm sure those lives would have been, I mean, I did the musical theatre bit for a stint, would have been more, less heavy, that's for sure. But this work called me, it became me, and I couldn't ignore the magnetic current of being pulled towards serving something greater than me. And I think that's it. Some of us have these very, very clear purposes, and we cannot do anything but they are part of us. And I truly believe that's where I am right now. But each of us have individual responsibility in contributing towards change, in leaving the world better than when we entered it, in not just taking, but giving back, and becoming, evolving, and being a better human along the way. I always say this work is about collective healing. When we heal our inner stuff, when we heal our inner wounds, when we heal our shit, the stuff that we've been dealt, the pain that we are carrying, how we show up in the world has a knock-on effect. We wouldn't be going around, you know, there's a caveat here, we wouldn't be going around kneeling on a person's neck. You know, I say there's a caveat because there are some human beings who have sociopathic tendencies, and I'm not discounting that. But there are others who are holding and carrying wounds that with some support and healing, you know, how we show up in the world is going to be different. Some people just need to be incarcerated and that's the end of it. But, you know, what he's saying is, you know, our role here for the majority of human beings, like, we're not born to hate one another. We are not born to want to kill other human beings. That's not normal behavior for us. It's definitely been learned and taught. And in order for things like the transatlantic slave trade to have continued for so many centuries, in order for white people to have believed that they are a more superior race and that it's okay to whip and have public lynchings and turn up on a Saturday and call them, you know, be a spectacle and a family day out, which is what they were, in order for that to be normalized and to be justified, they had to dehumanize us as black people. And when we start dehumanizing each other, we start moving in very, very dangerous grounds, because those are the ingredients that have contributed to every single incident of violent mass genocide in our history, when we start dehumanizing one another. So we have to be vigilant of when we are doing that, even through our words. So John Lewis, I just want to share this a little bit because there's a reference I want to give you. So Barack was talking about some of the things that John Lewis did. So John Lewis died around 80 years old, which is remarkable, because civil rights activists in particular, generally there's research that shows have a lower life expectancy. Whether that's been assassinated or, you know, getting ill, I don't know. But John Lewis was around doing incredible work for civil rights for nearly 80 years. He was dedicated to it. And he was part of the group of people who were the Freedom Riders. So who would take part in nonviolent civil disobedience. And there is a clip in a film, and I think the film was by Danny Glover. Double check, fact check that for me. But the film is called Freedom Song, and I think that came out around 2000. And there is a very, very powerful clip within that film where they're showing what African American people did in this era to be able to resist and to be able to affect change, challenge the norms. Around the height of segregation. And this clip shows, like, let me know what you, like training, I guess, is how you would describe it. The training of how to help people like John, to be able to withstand the abuse that you're going to get from being disobedient, non-violently. So if you follow my Instagram, you'll have seen me put something on there about a young man who sat in a caf and sat in the white area of the caf as a black man, and would have milkshake poured over his head and verbal abuse, physical abuse, ribs kicked, ribs broken, and they did not resist, did not respond, sat there. You hear about the Rosa Parks, you know, the greats, the names that we all know. And it only just dawned on me the power of resisting. Like if you go back through generations, it's not merely about being disobedient. It's literally about saving your life. Because if you dared to show, if you dared to kick back, if you dared to rightfully retaliate to the abuse that you're experiencing, the implications of that, if you go back through ancestry, was lynching. There's a real fear, understandable, palpable fear for people who are black, of speaking up about the racism that they experience to this day. Fear of retribution is real. Because if you spoke up or you retaliated or you responded, beaten, killed, imprisoned, lynched. Starting to connect and join the dots together. So John Lewis was somebody who was part of a massive non-violent civil disobedience campaign, and withstanding this trauma, you know, taking this abuse, all of these things led to change. I'm not saying these are the things that we need to do now. But I say it a lot in my teaching that this work, becoming actively anti-racist, like being part of a movement of change, requires so much courage. Because we are rocking the status quo. We were turning everything we learned upside down. We're challenging everything that we have incorrectly learned about racism. And so that's the other element. There is such a lack of understanding about what racism fundamentally is. And so for me, a lot of the work that I do is about educating about what systemic racism is. What racism is beyond and overt act of intentional and conscious hate. How that manifests in you. How that manifests in your mate. How that manifests in your colleague who also sits within another minority identity. How that shows up. The power of that. So, and I think when John Lewis started doing this, he was only 20 years old. They often, you know, as a result of the movement, the BLM movement resurge, I should say, because it's never not been there. There were lots of articles saying, like, it's the youngsters that are really bringing forth change. And we often put this burden on youngsters to be the next generation to change things, but it's all our responsibility. Parents hold a huge responsibility in not passing down their BS and to their children. Any of us who have access to work with young people have a huge responsibility, but it's not theirs alone. Can't, you know, we can't shift and change without being all we are all inextricably linked. So I have some notes today. I don't normally do these. I don't normally do my podcasts with notes, but there are so many things I want to say and I don't want to miss bits. But it was just in hearing, you know, some of the words that Barak was saying about John Lewis, some of the things that we're hearing about what he did and he advocated for. We do this thing in this work where we them and us, where we good or bad, where we racist, non-racist, John Lewis was a congressman, and so he demonstrated that you can be for protest and politics. It's not one or the other. There is this appetite and this feeling that we need to completely get rid of the police. That makes no sense to me. We don't need to completely get rid of the police. We need to reform the police. We need to wean out the institutionalized racism from which it was born. That's what we need to do. We don't need to get rid of the police entirely. Just like, you know, in protesting, what we want is to see change in laws. Like, we can't, that doesn't happen without politics. Like, we are all inextricably linked. These things can coexist together. And actually, what we are wanting is for things to be better within these systems that are corrupt as hell, or institutionally racist as hell, or both. And, you know, understanding that the two things need to coexist, I think, is really going to be vital when we start doing the lemon and us-ing and the gooding and the badding and, you know, those racists over there. No. Why are you focusing on those racists over there? Let's go back to ourselves, shall we, and start to interrogate what this actually looks like within ourselves. Because it's easy for us to blame and project onto others, because it distracts us from doing the work ourselves and from uncovering things about ourselves that don't make us feel great. But that's necessary for change. It's necessary. Anyway, so what the thing that, I'm tying this together, bear with me, we're coming to the final stretch. One of the other things that John Lewis talks about is, if we do not remain vigilant, any progress we make will be futile. It will fall by the wayside. We will become complacent. We will become apathetic. I'm already seeing that in the kickback and the blame and the exasperation about statues and BLM and the fact that this racist attack that happened in Bristol, the same city that there was all of this news coverage around with statues being torn down, there was this powerful and palpable silence about such a racist, violent attack that happens on Friday, the 24th of July, 2020. Because what also happened on Friday, 24th of July, over the weekend, was a rapper who I had never heard of called Wiley, who went on a bigoted, abhorrent, anti-Semitic tirade on his Twitter. Though Lord knows what motivates anyone to start spreading their bile via social media, but many sadly do. It's become a cesspit of hate, Twitter in particular. And understandably, a lot of Jews and also non-Jews were really hurt by his actions. And I talk about it a lot. Like, sometimes, like, not sometimes, all of the time, when you receive any kind of abuse and it comes from people who also belong to another marginalized identity, it hurts that much more, because we all know what it's like to be discriminated against, and yet we do it to ourselves. So this caused, understandably, a whole load of hurt. What happened in terms of timing? So this rant happened over the weekend, and it went on for, this tirade went on for quite some time, which also makes me get curious about what on earth is going on behind the scenes for someone to do that. But it also coincided with this violent, a racist attack. News cycles chose to primarily churn out Wiley. We need to be vigilant, because this stuff is gaining momentum right now, because we're turning everything on its head. There is a race hierarchy that we, I think Yazzie and I spoke about it in our podcast episode. In fact, I've probably spoken about it more times. Again, a reminder of this race hierarchy that we participate in, and that was built. Like, race is a social construct. This stuff is learned. Like, it didn't used to exist. I think the... racking my brain now. I think there is some evidence to suggest we started to show signs of discriminating against one another based on colour in the 15th century. And then we really started building race as a social construct in the 18th century. So, you know, the height of the transatlantic slave trade, like, it didn't exist. We didn't used to do this to one another. But that race, that race as a social construct was founded upon white being the most superior, the purest. And I'm not saying this, that I believe this. This is what this is coming from. The purest. And right at the bottom of that race hierarchy is black, being the least superior. And I'm saying this more so in the West, because if you have been raised in a black majority country, I'm not saying you haven't been impacted by the power of white supremacy and the colonization, but your programming around this race hierarchy probably doesn't even exist. Definitely in the West, more so, not exclusively. Certainly impacted those countries that we, the British Empire, colonized. So if you have learned that white is the most superior, that means something has to be the most inferior. You cannot have a system of white supremacy without the complete opposite. So at the moment, what we're doing is we're rocking that boat. We're saying, actually, this is nonsense and I will no longer participate in this because it's a construct. It didn't exist. We've learned it and we're continuing to participate and be complicit in it. Understanding that is going to be key in how you start to talk about what racism fundamentally is. That's what racism was born out of. It's evolved for sure. That's what it's born out of, and that's what we're still experiencing now. And what's been really, really interesting, just in terms of not being held to the same standards. Okay, I'll give you an example of my own experience. Recently, I've had a huge, you know, because of the climate that we've been, I've had an increase in people coming to my work before they've come to me. So most people find me and they follow me, and there is an element of building trust and, you know, a nurture sequence that goes on. For all of those who are in marketing and sales, you will know what I'm talking about. That happens before a person decides to book with you. But what's happened as a result of this sudden awakening of racism in the UK is that people are coming to my work before they're coming to me. And this one person inquired and said, look, I'm really, you know, if I could sign up to your course today, I would. It's been paid for by my employer and they basically want to know whether you're credible or not. These weren't the words that were used. And so I obviously, as every business person, as we all do this when we're buying a service, right? We will look at that service provider. We will look at, we will gain an understanding of their credibility by their online presence, by other testimonials, potentially by evidence of who they've worked with before, and by other things that, you know, help you build trust as to whether or not I'm some dodgy person on the internet who's going to rip you off. So even though I have this footprint of this online course that's been available for well over a year, people that have graduated through it, testimonials, public records of big corporates that I've worked with, a media expert regularly on Sky News, on BBC News, doing a commentary on racism at the Royal Wedding, articles in the Stylist magazine, CNN News, Refinery 29, videos all of me all over the internet, a following of over 45,000 followers on Instagram alone, a TED talk, a book coming out, being published by HarperCollins next year. That still wasn't enough evidence for this employer to ascertain that I was credible or not. That's everything about not being held to the same standards, the hoops that you have to jump through in order to demonstrate that you are of value, that you are in a, that are you are in a leadership role, to be trusted. These are all of the ways in everyday life that we have to demonstrate. We hear it, and some of my brown peers will hear this too. It is drummed into us. You have to work twice as hard as your peers to be at least be given the same access to the same opportunity. Barack Obama, as I mentioned, still not seen the same, still not treated the same, still not valued the same. Systemic racism. And it means that we're not held, we black people are not held to the same standards. I'll give you a very, very loose and clear one that we cannot contest. Barack Obama, I've just been reminded of his greatness because of his eulogy. Can you imagine if he behaved in the way that Donald Trump is behaving in his presidency? If he called the coronavirus the Chinese virus? If he talked about grabbing, what is it? What's that vile thing he said? Grabbing the pussy by the horn? What was that? I mean, if he said those things, do you think he would still be in his role? Do you think he would even got there in the first place? And I'm not saying that Donald Trump is the standard that I aspire to. I'm glad we are held to a higher standard because it means that when we show up, we show up. There is excellence because we cannot, there is no way we can move through the world and behave like somebody like Donald Trump. And yet he's the most powerful, one of the most powerful men in the world right now. That's a very clear example. There was an let me go back. I'm joining the dots now. There's an article somebody shared with me, I think on Monday, that was speaking about the attack in Bristol. So the young hospital worker who was had a racist attack. The BBC article wrote, the headline was something, racist attack in Bristol. And the word racist attack was in inverted comments. Notice how often our British media does this. An industry that is 94% white continues to put racist, racism, whatever, in inverted comments, and how that feeds into the psychology and invalidates it, makes you question its validity. I did a direct comparison to the headlines that went out about Wiley's anti-Semitic raid. Do you think anti-Semitism was in those inverted commas? No, there was no question. There was no question. And this happens again, part of the work I'm doing with students is to get you to start to notice what systemic racism looks like and how it shows up in the everyday stuff that we are consuming and how that impacts our behaviour, our belief systems, our values, and whether or not we believe something to be true or not, whether we debate whether something is racist or not, or whether we believe it to be true at face value, even though this person had, and there were multiple witnesses, and it's being dealt with by the police, and people were heard saying fucking nigger, we still have the inverted comments. Wow. That's another way. So let me just tie it all together. So what I also noticed was the speed. And again, this is the speed that we should all be asking of and demanding from our social media platforms when they are horrible, harmful, racist, bigoted, abusive tirades online. How long did somebody like Katie Hopkins have a Twitter platform for? The amount of times it was reported, the amount of people who were harmed. She had that for years. She also had a verified tick, the Tommy Robinsons of the world, able to spread their bile and their hate, Britain's first, for years. And accounts are reported and it's not taken down. Why is that? Start to get curious about why is that not held to the same standards. And the bit I want to talk about was an article written by UK journalist Owen Jones. And he was talking about all of this stuff, particularly off the back of everything that has happened with Wiley and anti-Semitism and the way in which politicians have responded, social media platforms have responded. And it starts to question and bring in, okay, so why when, you know, let's start to look at the discrepancy of how these things are dealt with. Let's start to look at how media perpetuates and contributes to spreading hate to people who are black and brown. Let's start to look at, the way in which our own prime minister has used Islamophobic and racist language over in articles online over and over again, and nothing. Why is it okay? No. Let me rephrase that. Why is it tolerated for some and not others? And then start to look at who it's been tolerated with and the race hierarchy. Who is closer to whiteness within these conversations? And you know the piece that. The thing that rounded that article up so much, and it's a Guardian article, so please do take a look, because it really does dissect this and beautifully demonstrates what systemic racism can look like within media, an industry that is 94% white. I'm going to say that again. When they uploaded the picture to go with the article, so the header image, we like to call those, they put an image of another rapper. And my mind escapes me. It's not in front of me. I don't have the name in front. Just go to the Guardian article and you'll find it. How many times does this happen when black people are misidentified over and over and over again? Even happened with Kobe Bryant, a huge basketball celebrity, if you like. Huge. Around his tragic death. And they put an image up of another player. This happens so much in media, and it's something that happens because it's something called the cross-race effect, where people of a different race find it difficult to identify people that there is within a different race of their own. And it happens a lot more so with people who are white. British journalism is 94% white. So, of course, again, so systemic racism isn't saying that all of these things are being done with intent to cause malicious harm or hate based on a conscious belief that one is more superior. That's not what systemic racism is. Systemic racism is that you can be kind, well-meaning, well-intentioned and still do things that are racist, assuming black people all look the same. Continuously, again, it's not isolated incidents, these are things that go on an ongoing basis, misidentifying black people, thinking they all look the same. These are cases that asked that whole Guardian article, and then the misidentification on top of it all was just, this is a beautiful demonstration of what systemic racism looks like in the UK. And this is the stuff that we need to disrupt. And this is the stuff that we need to be vigilant about. And being vigilant and disrupting this is necessary for change. We get into the state, and we're seeing it a lot. You're here on my episode with Mars. We were talking about that kindness, or just be kind, is so often used as a method with which to stop talking about racism. We just teach kindness here. Just be kind to one another and that will be enough. Well, how's that been working for you since slavery was abolished? How's that been working? I mean, it might be working for somebody who doesn't experience racism, but let's take a look and see, like, how is that method actually working? We have to address things consciously and intentionally, and we cannot fix what we do not know is broken because we are too scared to look. We're too scared to look at what lies underneath and how infected the wound has become because we keep putting plasters over it. This work is, you know, you hear me say this work is about collective healing. When we address our own wounds and we look at them and we unlearn and relearn, how we show up in the world is just so different. How we affect the people we come in contact with is so different. How we treat each other as human beings. It goes back to the very essence that I think we have lost. Like, we're not we are not born hating one another. We are not born thinking that one is more superior to another. We learn it. In the same way we learn it, we can unlearn it. But the unlearning process is going to be very, very painful. And most of us want to bypass our pain rather than deal with it because it feels easier and more comfortable. And when it comes to systemic racism, we're so good because it's not the overt. It often happens by good, kind human beings who consciously wouldn't want to cause harm to anyone and therefore can't possibly be racist as well. They don't understand that the two can and do coexist and have for centuries. You then start seeing this complete cognitive dissonance. And then you start to reject and not accept the evidence of racism, even when it's there in plain sight. Because by accepting the evidence that's there about racism when it's there in plain sight, I mean, you then start to have to challenge and question some of your own behaviour. And that's painful. So I just want to, again, around systemic racism, the kind of wrapping up, the Amy Coopers of the world, the videos that we see looming of white women predominantly, but not exclusively. There's a cognitive dissonance that I'm not racist. I remember here in the UK, I think it was a Ryanair flight. It was a low budget airline. A white guy was really upset about the fact that a black woman was sitting next to him and was being very, very abusive and racist to her. She was actually, I think she was, they'd just travelled to or from a funeral, and she was a black Caribbean woman and a black British Caribbean woman, and was just being verbally abused by this man who didn't want to sit next to her and was saying all sorts of horrible things about her appearance and how ugly she was. And they eventually did a follow-up piece in the press and challenged him on his behaviour and said, well, do you think that was racist? He's like, no, I'm not racist. So there's this complete cognitive dissonance that goes on in so many different settings, even those more overt stuff as well. This inability to be able to accept the evidence of racism. But it's not unconscious. It's conscious. We convince ourselves that it's unconscious. It's absolutely conscious. So from the Amy Coopers of the world, who know that she will be backed up by a system that if she calls the police and lies about something that a black man is doing, the police are far more likely to believe her account of events than they would a black man. And then, of course, the system and the power behind a police officer being able to put his knee on the neck of a black man for 8 minutes and 46 seconds as nonchalantly and whilst having his hands in his pockets, and nobody does a goddamn thing because he knows that he's supported by the power of white supremacy. That's an extreme example, but it's one nevertheless. Something happened here in the UK. It was IKEA. It was a furniture store. If it wasn't IKEA, similar to that, where there was a people of colour shopping, and there was a white couple. And something happened, pre-camera being turned on, that led to this white man, I think in particular, racially abusing the people of colour who were off camera. And you saw them, the more they challenged, say that again, what you just said there was racist, the more they challenged the behaviour, the more erratic the behaviour of the white couple became. And there was a point where they said, I'm calling the police, and they're like, call the police, like, I want you to call the police. And then it turned into this dramatic act of help, 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 they're harassing me. Like, you just see it, right? You just see the complete cognitive dissonance and this unwillingness to accept that that behaviour in that moment was coming from a place of white supremacy, and that was racist. Another example of when we pretend that this isn't conscious, but it is, we just don't accept it because what will it mean about me or people like me if I do? Jane Elliott, look this up. It's still on the internet. She's an academic, and she was teaching a class of predominantly white students. It wasn't all, but predominantly. And she asked them a question. She was talking about race, and she asked the question, raise your hands if you have the opportunity to be black. Put your hand up or stand up. And nobody put their hand up. And so she, and I mean, there's more to it than this, by all means, go and Google the clip. She identified in that teaching moment that our racism that we pretend is subconscious is absolutely conscious. Because even if we aren't going out and doing over horrendous acts like I've described some in this post, we participate in this racial hierarchy and this system of white supremacy that has fed to us and that we have believed or become complicit in knowing, you know what, I'm not going to put my hand up because I know that it's better to be white. And they wouldn't dream of acknowledging that, but the fact that nobody put their hands up spoke volumes. And there was a really interesting account from Dr. Robin DiAngelo that she shared. She grew up, these are her words, in incredible poverty, often would be experiencing quite profound starvation. And she knew that as a result of their poverty, I think she was also raised with her mother, that she was looked down upon. So here's the intersection of class, that she was looked down upon by other white people who were not experiencing poverty. So that was going on. That systemic othering and discrimination was going on by other white people. But she knew at a young age, as a little girl, that being white and poor was better than being black. She'd already learned that as a little girl. And the moment that she shared where she learned that was when they were, in a park or somewhere where there was a public bench. And on that bench was some food, and she was famished. They obviously hadn't been able to eat for quite some time, was absolutely starving. And she reached out for whatever leftover food was on the top of this picnic table bench. And her mum says, no, don't touch that. It could be dirty. It could have been touched by a coloured person, which of course was some of the language that we used to use to describe people who were black before it became offensive. And she knew in that moment that she was white and that it was better to be white than be black. That's conscious. That's conscious. And I'm asking you, I'm inviting you on this journey to be aware of this stuff, to be aware of what systemic racism looks like, to be aware when there is cognitive dissonance, to be aware of when you recognize that your rage about some types of injustice, there's more energy for some types of injustice than others. You notice where your energy around racial injustice is more selective. Notice it. Important to notice it, because we do this thing where we start theming and us-ing, and we become divided. And the system of white supremacy wants us to become divided. That's how it functions, because we are less powerful when we're theming and us-ing. So don't buy into that. Don't buy into that. The them and the us-ing. And don't think that by acknowledging, by accepting what systemic racism looks like, what this race hierarchy looks like, and where you hold societal advantage, as well as where you experience societal disadvantage, noticing that those two things coexist doesn't take away from your own individual experience of receiving some kind of systemic discrimination. I'm talking specifically for those of us who intersect in different identities. The more identities you sit in, the more intense and the worse your experience and your treatment is going to be. Like, recognizing where you hold societal advantage and also where you experience discrimination shouldn't take away from your own experience of discrimination. But what we do, we start them in the nothing, we go into this, the conversations about, we start having what I like to call, and others, oppression Olympics. And when we are divided, we are far less powerful. So it's being aware of that. It's being aware of when you're saying something, but your behavior's doing something else. And just being aware of what is acceptable in society, where we allow racism and specifically anti-blackness to be perpetuated and elongated, and where other forms of discrimination, it's not tolerated. The question is, why is it tolerated? Or why is it tolerated for longer? Why is it not addressed? Big questions for a last episode, but just something to think about. So this work, my friends, requires courage, remaining vigilant, like starting to see the contradictions and the hypocrisy, starting to better understand what racism is beyond an overt act of conscious and intentional hate, and recognizing what it looks like in these sort of hidden and seductive ways that, you know, is in the fabric of the DNA of this country. Like, overcoming complacency, challenge media, challenge friends when they make comments, challenge colleagues. I can surrender to the fact that you're going to have isms. Like, there is no way in hell you can be born and raised in a country that participated in the entire construction of the system of white supremacy and have not internalized that. There is no way. Like, if I, as a black woman, has internalized racism as a result of what has been fed, the bile that I've been fed, and I have to excavate and unlearn that, then if you are not black, that's going to be present within you too. How it manifests, of course, is going to be different depending on our own backgrounds, upbringing, values and belief systems. But it will be there, and we have to dare to look. Otherwise, we will not change. And there'll be activists that, you know, we're not moving things further forward. We're just staying static. And I we should all be wanting to leave the world better than when we entered it. So to round up, what this thing is really good at doing, what the system of white supremacy is really good at doing, is leaving us apathetic, is contributing to us feeling like it's too big. The system is too big for us. And my parting words is, don't buy into the disillusionment. Like, and remember and start learning. Like, one of the reasons I love learning about, you know, the forgotten history, black history, is hearing about all of the people that came before us who endured, what they had to withstand. Because then you do see the change. You also see where we need to do a lockdown better. But you do see the change. And you do see what's possible. You do see that changing hearts and minds and human beings is entirely possible. I see it in those who start my anti-racism course and how they come out at the end of it, how they become the work, how they are there, how they show up in the world, in their relationships, in how they parent, in how they are there to just hold space for me when I am in pain and trauma, in a way that growing up with friends over a 20-year period have never been able to do because they haven't done the work. The work works when you do the work. And I invite you to go back to listen to episodes where I'm exploring this with Natalie or Selena and people who are actively engaged in the work right now. It works. We have to believe that it works. We have to trust that it works. And ultimately, especially now, because it feels hard, I acknowledge that it's been a hard week for me personally. We cannot lose hope, because that's the thing that drives through change and sees us through darkness. We cannot lose hope. I think that's where I'm going to leave it. There are so many more things I wanted to say, but it's 51 minutes. Thank you so much for joining me on the first season of Conversations with Nova Reid. I have every intention of bringing season 2 to you at the end of autumn beginning of winter, with even more conversations, with even more incredible human beings who are role modeling change in their own way, in their lives, in their communities, with even more conversations that will challenge you and make your toes curl. because that's what this is about. Like, we are imperfect. We need to lose and surrender to being perfect. Like, it doesn't exist. And being up for the challenge of simply doing and being better. So I cannot end this episode without thanking every single guest who has taken part in this podcast. I'm literally going to name them all. Susan Atte, Selena Barker, Mars Lord, Kadifa Wong, Donna Lancaster, Joanne Bradford, Nicola Ray Wickham, Chloe Davis, Tamu Thomas, India Martin, Yazzie Min, Ade Adeniji, Janelle Lewis, and Natalie Elaine. And I cannot forget my dad. I would love to hear what your favourite episode has been throughout this series and why. Feel free to drop an email to hello@novaread.com or find me on Instagram, Nova Read Official. Equally, a huge thank you to those of you who have become and are still continuing to support through Patreon. That will help me ensure that I'm able to bring season two to you. And keep this podcast going. It's just me, myself and I in my whichever room my kitten isn't in, distracting me and taking you along this journey. It's been an absolute pleasure to be able to keep you company and also, you know, have some real human conversations. It's been, you know, so many of my guests have said, they sent me an email afterwards saying, thank you, that conversation felt like therapy. But so many of us, you know, and I have intentionally, the majority of my guests have been Black, and that is with intention. So many of us don't have an opportunity to have open-hearted and honest conversations through fear of retribution, through fear of not being heard, through fear of gaslighting. And we're so often not seen, heard, and understood. And being seen, heard, and understood is one of the most healing things you can do for somebody who experiences systemic oppression. Just listen and hold space. It's one of the most powerful and healing things you can do. We have to believe that change is possible. And I think that we reinforce that by having the courage to take on this work ourselves. Because when you start to see how profound and impactful change is when you do this work on yourself, you will start to see the power and the opportunity and enormous hope for what's possible when other people have that realization too. So that's it from me. If this work is calling you, if the conversations in this entire series have moved you to want to start your own individual journey, then I cannot wait to welcome you onto my anti-racism course, where there are other change makers doing this work out in the world. And so you can be part of the movement of change, where we go beyond talking and taking action so that outcomes change, and so that in 30, 40, 50, 60 years' time, another version of Nova, the activist, isn't having these exact same conversations. The pain of going through history and hearing from greats like James Baldwin and hearing him say pretty much the same conversations in the 60s that we're having today, that's not passing the baton on. You know, we ultimately want to leave the world better than when we entered it, and so that this work is continued, not going backwards. And we can only do that by taking individual accountability believing that change is possible, experiencing that change is possible. And as I always like to say, creating that tidal wave of change. So that's it from me. My beauts for season one. I need to go away and bury my head into the book to get it finished for you. It's an all-consuming process, and I can't wait to be able to come back and share more about all of the wonderful chapters and letting you know what's going out in the world. But I cannot write the book and do this as well. So thank you for joining me for season one. You know what to do. For the last time this season, if this episode resonates with you, please leave a review. Remain vigilant, remain courageous, remain curious, remain open to learning, remain open and willing to grow and expand and be a better human being. And most importantly, don't underestimate your own individual capacity for change and the power that you have to influence others around you. Don't underestimate that. And mostly, my friends, do not lose hope.